Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Alumni Association titled The Second Founding, How the Civil War and Reconstruction Forged a Constitutional Revolution. Our speaker is Eric Foner, DeWitt Clinton Professor Emeritus of History at Columbia University. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Boston University Professor of Political Science, Nita Crawford.
Eric Foner is the DeWitt Clinton Professor Emeritus of History at Columbia University. He's the author of nearly two dozen books, works that span the breadth of American history, from Thomas Paine and Revolutionary America to Lincoln to Reconstruction, and his important work, Who Owns History? Rethinking the Past in a Changing World. Professor Foner's most recent book is Gateway to Freedom, The Hidden History of the Underground Railroad, which focuses on New York City in the 19th century, but puts the entire Underground Railroad in perspective, clarifying myths, adding texture and names and places. Along the way, we see many things in a new light. For example, the pivotal role of New York City during the first emancipation in America by the British during the Revolutionary War. And we better understand the role of money in the massive and sustained act of civil disobedience and interracial cooperation that was the Underground Railroad. Eric Foner is a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He's also done something of a historian's hat trick by being at different times president of the Organization of American Historians, president of the American Historical Association, and president of the Society of American Historians. His other hat trick occurred in 2011 when his book, The Fiery Trial, Abraham Lincoln and American Slavery, won the Lincoln Prize, the Bancroft Prize, and the Pulitzer Prize. The title of his lecture tonight is The Second Founding, How the Civil War and Reconstruction Forged a Constitutional Revolution. Please give a warm Boston University welcome to Professor Eric Foner.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks for that very kind introduction. I'm very happy to be here in Boston to, and especially to give this lecture in honor of Howard Zinn. I should say that lately, we in New York have had a bit of an inferiority complex vis-a-vis Boston, at least in terms of sports results. We're confident that that historical change will take place in this realm. But before my lecture, I want to add a couple of words about Howard Zinn. I came to know him late in his life. I was involved with him in a number of events in the early part of this century. Anti-war events, not anti-Vietnam War, anti-Iraq War. Under the Bush administration. I got to know him pretty well then, but many years before that, I played a little bit of a role in his career because it was me who the New York Times turned to write the review in the New York Times book review of his book, People's History of the United States, which came out around 1980. And we always used to joke. I gave a very positive review, and I always felt he owed me several beers down the road as a result of that. As you know, the Civil War and Reconstruction transformed American society in innumerable ways. But maybe the most tangible legacies of that period surviving today are the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which were added to the U.S. Constitution then. They wrote a new definition of American citizenship and the rights it entails into the Constitution. They forged a new relationship between individual Americans and the national state. So profound were the changes that these amendments sought to accomplish that they should be seen not simply as alterations in an existing document, but as really a constitutional revolution, as I give in the title here, or a second founding, the creation of a new constitution in the aftermath of the Civil War. The second founding, I should say, is the title of a book that I've written about these amendments that will be coming out in September, so you'll hear more about it probably then. But anyway, Reconstruction was both a specific time period, the years after the American Civil War, and a historical process which didn't really have any fixed beginning and end, the process by which the United States tried to come to terms with the consequences of the Civil War and particularly the destruction of the institution of slavery. We might almost say that we're trying still to work out the results of the end of slavery in our country, and in that sense, Reconstruction never really ended. Now, I've devoted much of my scholarly career to that period, but I have to acknowledge that most Americans know very little about it. But the fact is that even if we don't recognize it, Reconstruction is part of our lives today. Or to put it another way, key questions facing American society right now are Reconstruction questions. These are on the front pages of our newspapers every day. Who is entitled to citizenship? That's a Reconstruction question. Who should have the right to vote? That was settled in Reconstruction, but it's not settled anymore, apparently. Terrorism was a phenomenon of Reconstruction. Not the terrorism we've been used to from abroad, but homegrown American terrorism of the Ku Klux Klan and kindred organizations. Every session of the Supreme Court adjudicates cases arising from the 14th Amendment, particularly. You can't understand American society today without knowing something about that period a century and a half ago. Reconstruction is also a prime example of the politics of history, which was the title of one of Howard's books. I'm not talking about whether the historian is a Republican or a Democrat. I mean the way in which historical interpretation both reflects and helps to shape the politics of the time in which the historian is writing. For most of the 20th century, what we call the Dunning School, after one of my predecessors at Columbia long ago, William A. Dunning, professor there, dominated historical writing and popular thinking about that period. In that view, in a nutshell, Reconstruction was the lowest point in the saga of American democracy. It was a time of misgovernment and corruption caused by the misguided decision to give black men, most of them former slaves, the right to vote. According to these scholars, black people are innately incapable of participating intelligently in political democracy, and that's what produced the alleged horrors of Reconstruction. This interpretation dominated historical scholarship and popular memory for many, many, well into the 20th century. Its longevity arose from the fact that it harmonized with the racial system of the United States in the first half or more of the 20th century, from 1900 until the Civil Rights era. The political lessons of that view of Reconstruction were very clear. First of all, it was a mistake to give black people the right to vote, and therefore the white South was justified, correct, in taking away the right to vote around the turn of that, around 1900. And if you gave them back the right to vote, you'd have another replay of the horrors of Reconstruction. Secondly, Reconstruction was imposed by Northern outsiders. Maybe some of them were motivated by humanitarian concerns, but the result proved that only white Southerners really understand race relations in the South, and therefore the white South should resist outside calls for change. As these calls for change accelerated in the 1930s and 40s, the emphasis on the supposed disaster of Reconstruction became more and more strident in the South. In 1944, Gunnar Myrdal, in his famous book, The American Dilemma, An American Dilemma, wrote that, he said, when pressed about the black condition, white Southerners will regularly bring forward the horrors of the Reconstruction governments and of black domination. Now, when the Civil Rights Revolution took place, The pillars of the old interpretation, especially its overt racism, fell to the ground, and Reconstruction was completely reinterpreted. Today, most historians see it as a noble, if unsuccessful, effort to establish for the first time in American history an interracial democracy, a precursor of the modern civil rights movement, which was often called the Second Reconstruction. If Reconstruction was tragic, we now think, it was not because it was attempted, but because it failed, and thus left to subsequent generations the difficult problem of racial justice. Now, to understand how, despite its immediate failure, Reconstruction shaped our history in significant ways, we have to remind ourselves of the status of African Americans when the Civil War broke out. There were about 4 million slaves in the United States in 1860. Slavery was powerful, expanding, and economically thriving. It was not going away. There were more slaves in the United States in 1860 than at any other moment in our history. Slavery shaped the definition of American nationality, giving it a powerful racial dimension. On the eve of the Civil War, according to the Supreme Court in the famous Dred Scott decision, no black person could be a citizen of the United States. Citizenship was for white Americans only. This all didn't only apply to slaves. Free black people, even if their families had been here for generations, could not be American citizens. The only people before the Civil War who advocated a non-racial ideal of nationality were the abolitionists, black and white. They fought not only against slavery, but for equal rights as citizens for African Americans. Black political gatherings before the war consciously chose to call themselves conventions of colored citizens, putting forward a definition of citizenship based on birthright, not any concept of race. That is what came about in the Constitution as a result of Reconstruction. Now, in discussing these amendments, I want to note that whether the courts should interpret the Constitution in accordance with the author's original intent or original meaning is a doctrine that's become central to conservative jurisprudence, but it's a political question, not a historical question. I have no interest in that question of whether people on the Supreme Court should try to parse the meaning of different words from 150 years ago. But it is worth noting that no historian believes that any important document possesses just one single intent or meaning. The 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were enacted not at one moment, but over the course of 5 years in response to rapidly evolving political and social imperatives and in a dynamic situation in which people's views were undergoing rapid change. Freezing our understanding of the amendments at the moment of their passage or ratification misses this dynamic quality of the whole era. It's certainly the job of the historian to try to ascertain what those who framed and voted on and debated these amendments hoped to accomplish. But those intentions have to be examined, and Howard Zinn would certainly agree with this, up and down the society, not simply at the top in court decisions or congressional debates. For example, the 14th Amendment was only ratified by a sufficient number of states because Congress in 1867 mandated the establishment of new state governments in the South with African American men for the first time in any significant numbers voting in elections and serving in these legislatures. These new biracial governments then ratified the 14th Amendment, creating the three-quarters of the states that needed to ratify it. Without black suffrage, no 14th Amendment. Well before the Civil War, black activists had developed an understanding of the rights of citizenship that included equality before the law, the right to vote, equal access to public accommodations and transportation, and other rights. Yet the ways in which black Americans understood the 14th and the other amendments are almost never considered when this intent is discussed, and they were consistently ignored by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has never paid any attention to what African Americans thought the 14th Amendment and the others actually were trying to accomplish. Now, in her memoirs written in the 1890s, the great feminist Elizabeth Cady Stanton recalled that Reconstruction, she wrote, involved the reconsideration of the principles of our government and the natural rights of man. The nation's heart was thrilled with prolonged debates in Congress and legislatures, in the pulpits and public journals, and at every fireside on these vital questions. All those debates are part of the meaning of these Reconstruction amendments, and that meaning changed over time as different Americans sought to make use of the amendments, often in ways not anticipated by those who wrote them. Now, the first of the Reconstruction amendments was the 13th Amendment, ratified in 1865, which irrevocably abolished slavery throughout the United States and introduced the word slavery for the first time into our Constitution. The original Constitution had used circumlocutions. It protected slavery, but it didn't mention it. It talked about other persons, persons held to labor. Many of the founders kind of hoped slavery would die out, and they didn't want the word slavery to be in the Constitution. It's the 13th Amendment that puts that word there. But why was the 13th Amendment necessary anyway? Hadn't Lincoln freed the slaves? On January 1st, 1863, President Lincoln declared over 3 million slaves free. But the Emancipation Proclamation left in bondage 750,000 in the 4 border slave states that had not seceded, Maryland, Delaware, Kentucky, and Missouri, because this was a war measure. Those states were not at war with the United States, so Lincoln didn't feel he had the authority to deal with slavery there. And he also exempted certain parts of the Confederacy. 750,000 slaves were not affected by the Emancipation Proclamation. Moreover, while freeing 3 million people, which is certainly an amazing accomplishment, the proclamation did not abrogate the state laws that established slavery. Emancipation, in other words, is not exactly the same thing as abolition. And even after issuing the proclamation, Lincoln continued to promote his favored policy of state-by-state abolition. States would repeal the laws that established the institution of slavery, as New York and Pennsylvania and other states had done after the American Revolution. Given the high bar to ratifying a constitutional amendment, this seemed more attainable. Lincoln required any Southern state that wanted to come back into the Union to abolish slavery as one of the requirements. Now, contrary to what one might conclude from a Hollywood movie of a few years ago, not Lincoln, but the abolitionists actually originated the 13th Amendment. The campaign was coordinated by the Women's National Loyal League, headed by Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. In early 1864, after receiving their massive petitions, the abolitionist Senator Charles Sumner of Massachusetts here proposed an amendment based on the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen from the French Revolution. His amendment would have read, "All persons are equal before the law, so that no person can hold another as a slave." Saying that this originated with the French was not the right political move, because Americans don't like the French that much. Jacob Howard of Michigan urged Sumner to, quote, "dismiss all reference to French constitutions and go back to good old Anglo-Saxon language." And the final language of the amendment was taken from the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, which had been written by Jefferson, and it said, "Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime, whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States." Now, that little except, allowing involuntary servitude for those convicted of crime, is an excellent illustration of the aphorism that historians write with one eye at least fixed on the present. For decades, scholars writing about the 13th Amendment, including me, I have to say, paid no attention to it. But with mass incarceration and the widespread use of prison labor, suddenly national issues, it has attracted considerable discussion, including in the Hollywood documentary a few years ago, 13th, which draws a straight line from the 13th Amendment to incarceration today. Actually, the coupling of a ban on slavery with a criminal exemption long preceded the 13th Amendment. As I say, it originated with Jefferson, really, although scholars have been unable to explain why Jefferson included it in the first place, except to note that he thought labor was good for building your character, so that people who worked as prisoners would become better citizens when they were released. But this wording was actually included in just about all the constitutions of the free states that barred slavery, starting with Ohio in 1803. By 1865, it was so familiar that it had become kind of boilerplate. It was just familiar language that no one even looked at that carefully. Only Charles Sumner sensed it might cause problems, and he later wrote that he regretted not moving to eliminate that clause. He didn't do so, he said, because his colleagues were impatient and, quote, anxious to get their dinner. I regret now my forbearance, he said. But inadvertently, the 13th Amendment had created a loophole that would later allow, when it was passed, there were hardly any prisons or prisoners, but later it would allow for the massive system of convict labor in the South, prison labor, chain gang labor, labor on plantations, and in the North also. And prison labor is still used down to the present by businesses, and to this day, courts have ruled that involuntary labor by prisoners does not violate the 13th Amendment. Sometimes unintended consequences are as important as the original intent. Now, abolitionists saw the 13th Amendment as the beginning of an even deeper transformation, what we would call today, this wasn't the phrase used then, but today we would call it regime change, changing a slavery-based regime to a regime based on freedom and equality. Now, most Republicans were not abolitionists, but they all agreed on certain principles. First of all, slavery had caused the Civil War and the death of 750,000 Americans. Second of all, it had done more than oppress slaves. It had deprived many white people of their liberties, such as freedom of speech in the South. The amendment intended to change all this and more. Unlike the Emancipation Proclamation, it applied to the entire country and for the first time made the abolition of slavery an essential part of the nation's legal order. In one respect, it was truly revolutionary. It abolished the largest concentration of property in the country. The slaves as property were worth more than any other kind of property, banks, railroads, factories in the United States. That was abolished with no compensation whatsoever to the owners. That kind of thing doesn't even happen in places like the French Revolution. That's a pretty radical act. Now, one congressman said, with the 13th Amendment, the one question of the age is now settled. But if it's settled, the fate of slavery, the 13th Amendment opened up a host of other issues. What exactly was being abolished? Property in human beings? Well, yeah, clearly. What about the racial inequality that was essential to slavery? Was that being abolished too? What did it mean to be a free person in post-Civil War America? These were the questions on which the politics of Reconstruction persistently turned. White Southerners had their own answers to these questions, as became clear when Lincoln was assassinated and Andrew Johnson became president. In the old view, Johnson was lionized as a hero, the great defender of the Constitution against the radical Republicans. Today, I think Johnson has a strong claim to being considered the worst president in American history. There are other claimants, but Johnson is a contender, I'll just put it that way. Johnson lacked all of Lincoln's qualities of greatness. He was deeply racist. He was incompetent. He had no sense of public opinion. He could not work with Congress. Johnson set up new governments in the South in the months after the Civil War, entirely controlled by white people. They enacted a series of laws which are called the Black Codes to try to force African Americans back to work on the plantations. They required all adult black men at the beginning of each year to sign a labor contract to go to work for a white employer or be deemed a vagrant and be auctioned off, fined, and if you couldn't pay the fine, auctioned off to work for someone who would pay your fine. These laws alarmed the Republican Party, which controlled Congress, into thinking that the South was trying to restore slavery in all but name. Most Republicans agreed that the 13th Amendment empowered Congress to ensure, as one congressman said, that the man made free by the Constitution is a free man indeed. In 1866, relying on the 13th Amendment, Congress passed one of the most important laws in American history, the Civil Rights Law, the Civil Rights Act of 1866, the first law to declare who is a free citizen of the United States and what rights they are to enjoy. The Civil Rights Act states that anybody born in the United States, except Native Americans living on their reservations, is a citizen. The Native Americans are considered still citizens of their own tribal sovereignties, but everybody else is a citizen of the United States, regardless of race, regardless of background, etc. Birthright citizenship is a statement that anybody can be a loyal American. Race, religion, national origin do not matter, nor does the legal status of your parents. It severs citizenship from race, as the abolitionists had long demanded. The idea remains controversial to this day. As you may recall, last year during the congressional election campaigns, President Trump talked about abrogating that portion of the 14th, it gets into the 14th Amendment then, that portion of the 14th Amendment when it comes to the children of undocumented immigrants, the children born in the United States. But the language is very plain. Anybody born in the United States, doesn't matter if your parents are here legally, illegally, makes no difference. Whether the president can actually unilaterally repeal part of the Constitution is an interesting question. The law went on to declare that all these citizens must enjoy basic legal equality. In other words, states can't pass one set of laws for black people, like the Black Codes, and one set of laws for white people. The Civil Rights Act didn't say anything about the right to vote, but it guaranteed what I would call the rights of free labor, the rights essential to compete in the marketplace, the right to own property, the right to sue and be sued, to go to court, to testify, to have the laws applied to you the same as everybody else. The language is very interesting. All citizens, said this law, must enjoy these rights the same as enjoyed by white persons. Before the war, the word white in laws was a barrier, a boundary, right? Only white people can vote. It was a privilege. Now whiteness becomes a baseline. Other groups are to enjoy these rights the same as white people. This is a remarkable shift. There were dozens and dozens of laws all over the country, North and South, which distinguished between white persons and everybody else in their rights. Now those laws are all abrogated by the Civil Rights Act of 1866. Andrew Johnson vetoed the Civil Rights Bill, and it became the first important law in American history enacted over a president's veto. His veto message denounced the law for what today is sometimes called reverse discrimination. This is what he wrote. The distinction of race is by the bill made to operate in favor of the colored and against the white race. And in the idea that expanding the rights of black people somehow takes something away from white people, we still hear today the ghost of Andrew Johnson haunting our discussions of race. But of course, a law can be repealed by another Congress. So very soon, Congress put these principles into the 14th Amendment, the most important change in the Constitution since the Bill of Rights. This is the longest amendment in the Constitution. It's complicated. It deals with a lot of different issues. In effect, it constitutionalizes the victorious Republican North's sense of what the Civil War had accomplished. It deals with the Confederate debt, which it abrogates, the Union debt. It deals with who can hold office in the South. It contains a convoluted clause saying that if any state denied any group of men the right to vote, they would lose some of their representation in Congress. This was sort of a compromise between radicals who wanted to give the right to vote to black men and other Republicans who felt that they might not be able to get that ratified. So they punished states that deprived black men of the right to vote. The women's movement at that time was very outraged by this because it introduced the word male into the Constitution for the first time. There was no gender distinction in the Constitution up to this point. But the heart of the 14th Amendment is the first section, which begins by constitutionalizing this principle of birthright citizenship, and then goes on to bar the states from abridging the privileges or immunities of citizens, without saying what exactly those were, or denying to any person, citizen or alien, not just citizens, the equal protection of the laws. Unlike the Civil Rights Act, the amendment is written in the language of general principles: equal protection, due process, life, liberty, or property. Not specific rights. It leaves it up to future Congresses to breathe meaning into these general phrases. The most radical change among those that I listed was in introducing the concept of equality for the first time into the Constitution. The word equal does not appear in the original Constitution, except in a clause saying what would happen if candidates for president got an equal number of electoral votes, or something like that. Sometimes I mention this, someone says, wait a minute, what about all men are created equal? But that's the Declaration of Independence. That's not the Constitution, and the Declaration of Independence is not a legal document. You can't go to court and claim your rights under the Declaration of Independence, although it's a pretty cool document anyway. The 14th Amendment makes the Constitution what it never was before, a vehicle through which aggrieved groups and individuals who believe they lack equality can take their claims to federal court. And the language is race neutral. It doesn't say anything about slaves or black people. It applies to everybody. And that has had enormous consequences in our own time. In recent decades, the courts have used this equal protection clause to expand the rights of numerous groups. The gay marriage decision, for example, a few years ago, 14th Amendment decision. Not that people in 1866 were thinking of gay marriage, but the principle of the law applying equally to everybody has expanded to include all sorts of issues which weren't on their minds 150 years ago. Now, so the first section of the 14th Amendment fundamentally transformed Americans' relationship to the government, and it asserted federal authority to protect the basic rights of all American citizens. In the words of one newspaper editor, it changed the Constitution, it changed a Constitution for white men into a Constitution for mankind. All three of these amendments also marked a fundamental shift in the federal system, that is, the relationship between the national government and the states. The Civil War had crystallized in the minds of Northerners the idea of a powerful national government protecting the rights of Americans. You can see my point if you compare these amendments to the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments which list our basic civil liberties. Freedom of speech, freedom of the press, separation of church and state, etc. The Bill of Rights was based on the idea that the main danger to liberty was a too powerful national government. It begins with the words, Congress shall make no law, dealing with freedom of speech, et cetera, et cetera. Congress shall make no law. Before the Civil War, the Bill of Rights did not apply to the states. It was to limit the federal government. Massachusetts, right here, had an established church until the 1820s. Didn't that violate the First Amendment? No, because that applied to the federal government. The states could do anything they wanted. But now, the last clause of each of the three amendments says Congress shall have the power to enforce this amendment. from Congress shall make no law to Congress shall have the power. Now the federal government is seen as overseeing the states. The greatest danger to liberty comes from the abuse of power by the states, and the federal government has become what Charles Sumner called the custodian of freedom. Now, the 14th Amendment said nothing directly about the right to vote, but to guarantee that states would enforce this principle of equal citizenship, Congress in 1867 required, as I said, that new governments be created in the South with black men voting. And in 1870, the 15th Amendment extended the principle of black male suffrage to the entire nation. Massachusetts had allowed black men to vote all through its history, but most northern states, up until the 15th Amendment, did not allow, Ohio, Pennsylvania, et cetera, did not allow black men to vote. So the 15th Amendment was very sweeping in that regard, but it was actually not the amendment that the radicals wanted. The 15th Amendment says no state can deprive any male citizen of the right to vote. The radicals wanted a positive amendment saying all male citizens aged 21 and over have the right to vote. Neither of them was willing to go for female suffrage at this time. There was just simply not a majority for that. But what's the difference? The difference is that the 15th Amendment, as written, left open the possibility of other requirements, ostensibly non-racial, that would actually severely limit the black vote. Literacy tests, property qualifications, poll taxes. As long as they weren't racially defined, they didn't seem to violate the 15th Amendment, or at least that's what the courts said. So the amendment's purpose could too easily be circumvented, and indeed, around the turn of the next century, that's how the southern states took away the right to vote. They didn't say, hey, no black people can vote. They passed all these laws, and particularly what they called understanding clauses. To register to vote, you have to show that you understand the state constitution. Well, you could be a black PhD and walk in, and the registrar would say, hey, you don't understand this, I'm sorry, and therefore you're not registered. And any white guy who came in, they would allow to register. So even though it didn't say anything about race, all these qualifications were used to eliminate the black vote, and the 15th Amendment had allowed this kind of circumvention. But the advent of black suffrage in the South did inaugurate this period we call radical Reconstruction, when biracial governments really came to power for the first time in American history. They had many accomplishments. They created the first public school systems in Southern history. They elected black men to office at every level. Two black men served in the U.S. Senate, 14 in the House. Hundreds and hundreds at the state and local level, from legislatures to justices of the peace and school board officials. This was a revolutionary change in the American political climate. Now, of course, the problems of emancipated slaves were not just political. They came out of slavery with no economic wherewithal. They had hoped for land distribution. It didn't happen. But the political revolution was dramatic enough that it inspired, as I mentioned, a wave of terrorist violence. The Ku Klux Klan and other groups, the White League and the White Knights of the White Chameleon, things like that. And that went in hand in hand by the 1870s with a retreat in the North from this principle of equality. One by one, the Reconstruction governments fell by the wayside until by 1877, all the southern states were back under the control of the white supremacist Democrats. During the next generation, from let's say 1877 to 1900, a new system of race was slowly put in place in the South, which we call by the shorthand Jim Crow. It rested on, as I said, disenfranchisement of black voters, severe cutbacks in public funding of black education, a labor market in which all the good jobs were reserved for whites, and policing the system, extra legal violence or lynching. The alleged misgovernment under Reconstruction became part of the intellectual underpinning of this system, a justification for this system. Now, didn't this racial system of inequality violate the Reconstruction amendments? They were still in the Constitution. With the conclusion of the Second Founding came the battle over its meaning, and ultimately it fell to the Supreme Court to construe the constitutional amendments. And over time, the court played a crucial role in this long retreat from Reconstruction. This is a part of our history that is well worth looking at today. What can happen to your constitutional rights in the hands of a conservative Supreme Court? The process was gradual, never total, but for African Americans, the consequences were that the broad conception of constitutional rights that they and their allies had attempted to put into the Constitution proved to be tragically insecure. Because all these amendments raised basic questions that needed to be resolved. How substantially had the federal system been changed? Did the 13th Amendment prohibit only chattel bondage, or what they called the badges and incidents of slavery? And what exactly were those? What were the privileges or immunities of citizens guaranteed in the 14th Amendment? What did equal protection of the laws mean? What about these disenfranchisement measures aimed at disenfranchising blacks but not mentioning race? Was that disfranchisement on the grounds of race, as the 15th Amendment seemed to proclaim? On all these issues, even though alternative understandings were readily available, the Supreme Court chose to restrict the scope of the Second Founding. By the early 20th century, the 14th and 15th Amendments had become basically dead letters throughout the South. In 1903, in a case coming out of Alabama, the Supreme Court threw up its hands. They were asked to overturn the Alabama system of voter registration, which eliminated all the blacks. And the Supreme Court basically said, you know, if the white majority wants to disenfranchise blacks in Alabama, there is nothing we can do about it. We are brought face to face with the consideration, wrote one newspaper, that the Constitution may be violated with impunity. The result demonstrated a sometimes forgotten point, which is that the Constitution is not self-enforcing. And it can become a dead letter if it's not enforced. And underpinning this jurisprudence and lasting long into the 20th century was this vision of Reconstruction, the so-called, the fake history, you might call it, of Reconstruction that was so dominant in legal scholarship and historical scholarship, etc. In 1945, in a case in that year, Justices Owen Roberts, Felix Frankfurter, and Robert Jackson wrote an opinion that it was, quote, familiar history that the Reconstruction legislation was motivated by a vengeful spirit on the part of Northerners. Familiar history, so familiar that those justices didn't even feel obligated to have a footnote with any justification for that interpretation of Reconstruction. It was just part of the general atmosphere of the time. In the late 19th century, though, an alternative rights-based constitutionalism emerged, particularly among black activists and their allies, which rejected the key tenets of Supreme Court jurisprudence. In 1889, in the midst of this constitutional retreat, a group of black lawyers and ministers in Baltimore formed an organization called the Brotherhood of Liberty, and they published a long book called Justice and Jurisprudence, the first sustained critique by black Americans of Supreme Court rulings interpreting the Reconstruction Amendments. The author proposed an alternative reading of the Constitution based on a broad conception of federal enforcement power and of citizens' rights. They said that the privileges and immunities of citizens extended way beyond what the Supreme Court understood. They even talked about what you might call economic rights as the privileges of citizens, that employment discrimination and housing segregation and the exclusion of blacks from labor unions were violations of the basic rights of American citizens. Can a citizen, they wrote, be daily excluded from the paths of industrial progress and yet be a citizen of the United States? They said no, but the Supreme Court said yes. Overall, as one book reviewer of their book wrote, too many rights had been lost as soon as they reached, quote, the graveyard of liberty, the Supreme Court of the United States. Now, today, the country has come a long way toward fulfilling the agenda of Reconstruction. But paradoxically, the recent history of these amendments reveals a tremendous expansion, as I mentioned, to protect the rights of all sorts of Americans who weren't even on the minds of Congress back then. I mentioned gay Americans, or the abortion rights decision comes out of the 14th Amendment. One man, one vote comes out of the 14th Amendment. But when it comes to racial issues, over the past generation, the court has narrowed and narrowed and narrowed the impact of the 14th and lately the 15th Amendments. And sometimes they go back to I didn't mention them by name, but the serious decisions limiting the amendments of the late 19th century, almost all of them have never been repealed. Plessy v. Ferguson was repealed in the Brown case as far as education is concerned. But most of those cases are still on the books and occasionally are even cited in Supreme Court opinions. The court cannot bring itself to say that for a century it has been wrong about what these amendments are really all about. But current jurisprudence doesn't have to be the final word. The counterinterpretation developed in Reconstruction and its aftermath, with its more powerful assertion of the rights enshrined in the Constitution, is still available if the political environment changes. There's no reason why the 14th Amendment's clause related to the privileges or immunities of citizens has to remain a dead letter, or why it can't be understood to encompass rights essential to full membership in American society, such as the right to an education, for example, or even the reasonable wages, quote-unquote, that Lincoln in the Emancipation Proclamation said the former slaves were now entitled to. I could go on and on about the court, but let me just make one further final point. We Americans like to think sometimes that our history is a straight line of greater and greater freedom. Actually, as Reconstruction shows, it's a more complicated story of ups and downs. As Howard Zinn reminded us many a time, rights can be gained and rights can be taken away to be fought for another day. Thomas Wentworth Higginson, a Boston abolitionist who commanded a unit of black soldiers in the Civil War, wrote, when Reconstruction began, revolutions may go backward. Reconstruction was a revolution, including a constitutional revolution, that went backward. But the fact that it happened at all laid the foundation for another generation, a century later, to try to bring to fruition the concept of a country beyond the tyranny of race. And however flawed, the era that followed the Civil War can serve as an inspiration for those of us striving to achieve a more just society. These ideals of freedom, equality, and democracy are always contested. Our understanding of the Reconstruction Amendments will always be a work in progress, but so long as the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow continues to plague our society, we can expect Americans to return to the Second Founding and to find there new meanings for our fractious and troubled times. So thank you very much for listening. Thank you.
I wonder if you could just address briefly the Compromise of 1876 when, through the disputed election and the Hayes-Tilden election, the Reconstruction becomes unwound. It's often said that the Northern politicians in the Republican Party had become fatigued by policing the South, and the Grant administration was over, and everybody wanted to turn away and move to other matters.
Right.
We can understand why the South would have been fatigued by this, but what was it about life in the North that made politicians get fatigued by this?
I think in the early 1870s, President Grant actually sent U.S. troops into the South and crushed the Ku Klux Klan. Congress had passed laws authorizing that under the 14th Amendment to enforce the 14th Amendment. Violence was depriving people of their constitutional rights. But the notion of constant military intervention in the South began to lose support in the North, particularly in 1873, there was the beginning of a serious economic depression, which lasted to 1877 or 78. It's almost like the focus of national attention shifted to the economy from the South. White propaganda about the, you know, black misrule and that kind of thing became more and more accepted in the North. 1877 is usually seen as the end of Reconstruction, although maybe it shouldn't be. The bargain that you referred to, in a nutshell, was that Democrats recognized Hayes, the Republican, as president in this disputed election, and the Republicans recognized white Democratic control of the entire South. But Hayes then became, it didn't really end just at that minute. Hayes then became disillusioned. He thought if they recognized this, the basic rights of the black people would be respected. And violence continued and disenfranchisement took place in some states. And by the end of his term in 1880, Hayes had sort of changed his mind and said, I think we made a mistake. And actually, President Garfield and Arthur, who we don't hear much about nowadays, actually continued or accelerated enforcement of voting rights in the South. So there's these ups and downs. History never ends at one particular moment. And it may be wrong, even though I did it in my own book, to say 1877 is the end of it. You might really go back to 1890, when Mississippi becomes the first state to take away the right to vote from all black men, basically, and then all the other southern states follow. Maybe that's really the end of Reconstruction, because the possibility of black political participation is eliminated. So it's complicated, like most things. Thank you all for coming.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You just heard a lecture by Eric Foner, DeWitt Clinton Professor Emeritus of History at Columbia University. Professor Foner's lecture was titled The Second Founding, How the Civil War and Reconstruction Forged a Constitutional Revolution, and was presented by the Boston University Alumni Association. Tonight's moderator was Boston University Professor of Political Science, Nita Crawford. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Lee Shuna. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.